Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
We're recording in progress.
We are. Good morning. Good morning. Got rid of the little reminder.
Yes, absolutely. There's this book, Long Players, Writers on the Albums that Shaped Them, edited by Tom Gatty. First appeared in the New Statesman as a feature. You're in this, Mark Ellen.
And you're in this.
Absolutely.
It's good. I thought it was good, actually.
I'm in this slightly more than you are.
Yeah, you are. You're quoted heavily in his introduction, and, more than once.
I just say that the feeling of being quoted is always a slightly kind of, it's an odd feeling. You think, yeah. Oh, God, your name appears in a sentence. You think, oh, my God, what did I say? And then somebody quotes you. It's just it's a strange feeling. I'm the rock writer.
Rock writer, David Hepworth.
Yeah. I think a radio program is say we're going to introduce you as rock critic. I said, can you find the last example of when I criticised any rock, please?
Being a rock critic. There's something about being a rock critic. A rock critic. It's rather kind of lowers the, you know, the sun seems to be setting slightly. Don't you think the clouds are a bit lower?
Yes,
the
absolutely.
Ceilings come down a few inches.
So the birds.
Is they going to be in the corner going, oh, I think you'll find that the birds were considerably better than the.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, small children stop smiling. You can't hear laughter in the streets. There are no longer dogs chasing strings of sausages, hanging off butchers' bicycles. All the fun of life has gone, and suddenly it's been replaced by a bloody Velvet Underground record. Oh, for Christ's sake, give it. Honestly, have rock critics increased the sum of human happiness, or have they reduced it? They have reduced it, Millard.
They probably have reduced it. Exactly, they have.
But anyway. What did you write about in here?
I read about the B-52s.
Oh, of course.
I'm not very good at finding those records that shaped my life or changed my life. I don't think my life has ever been shaped or changed by a record.
I didn't say that, actually, to be fair. The record is called
Writers on Albums That Shaped Them.
Fair enough. Yeah.
So I wasn't shaped by the B-52s' first album in 1979, but I just loved it.
I fancied
one of the B-52s.
Fred.
Fred.
Oh, it was Cindy, wasn't it?
Cindy Wilson. I thought they were great. Actually, I remember going to see them being absolutely captivated. It's a fantastic record. It's sort of science fiction and it's kind of synthesized pop music, and they look brilliant. Their clothes are funny. I don't know. I've got very happy memories of that time.
You did.
Randy Newman.
I tell you, because here's this record, and I happen to be able to piece together when and where I bought this record, which actually I can do with quite a lot of records, but this one, it's quite. I thought it was just one of those things where Kate Mossman, you know, it was a record of the New Statesman, asked me and a load of other people to do it. You know, it's a record that, you know, kind of figured in your life or you've had for a long time, means a lot to you or whatever. And that just came to my mind because I could remember the circumstances. I think it's June the 4th or something like that, 1972.
You actually mentioned it, didn't you?
It was something like that. You've probably got the thing in front of you. I'll tell you why I remember it, because my then-girlfriend, now wife, the current, the present Mrs. Hepworth.
Present Mrs. Hepworth.
and we went to see the Jay Giles Band at Midnight Court at the Lyceum. Do you remember those late night gigs?
God, I do.
I don't know why they did them so late.
The ballroom roof opened to the stars.
Well, yeah, possibly.
1st of July, 1972.
Okay, 72. Yeah, yeah. I was a huge fan of the Jay Giles Band, and we went to see them. And do you know who was supporting them? Brewer's Droop, Mark.
Oh,
we were only talking about the other week.
Into Bad Habit, didn't they? Was it bad? Or Good Habit? Good Habit?
No, that was different.
Oh, no, Brewer's Droop, yes.
Brewer's Droop.
Ron Watts.
He used to run the pub in High Wycombe. What's the pub called in High Wycombe? I can't remember.
Nag's Head?
It could be. And
I saw the
Cajun pub rock band. I always liked them. Anyway, Jay Giles Band. It was sensational, but it was very late at night, you know, although we were young in those days. And so we came out of the Lyceum about 2:30 in the morning, and we went and found the only place in London where you could get something to eat in the middle of the night, which is an all-night wimpy bar in Old Compton Street, which you can imagine, that's what it was. You know, it was a wimpy, and it was a lukewarm cup of tea, as it always was in those days. And then we walked all the way to King's Cross Station, which was closed, and we waited for the first suburban train to go back up to Palmer's Green, where she was living at the time. And, you know, I can remember it so clearly, you know, what a sleepy city London was in those days, you know, the middle of the night. Yeah. Anyway, we got back to Palmer's Green, we went to her flat, and then there used to be a record shop in Palmer's Green called Opus. And I used to go in there all the time, and I went in there, and there was Randy Newman's Sail Away just come out. And I knew Randy Newman's songs through other people's versions, but I'd never really heard him that much himself. Anyway, I remember I bought it, and we took it back to her flat, and we sat and listened to it. And if I'm honest, I thought it was a bit dry at the time, actually. I thought this doesn't give a lot as a record. But anyway, over the years, I kind of returned to it again and again. And what's interesting to me is what endures with records is very often that very quality of dryness. It's the less production there is, very often the better. We were talking about recently, Bob Dylan, John Wesley Harding.
Exactly the same. Very it's so lean, isn't it?
That's what makes it last.
And it doesn't mean it's dated. You know, it's production that you can date things.
Yeah, it is. Production. And also the great thing about Randy Newman is that he's the kind of poet of the unworthy thought, which is what I've always loved about him. You know, Randy Newman writes what your heart thinks, you know, not necessarily what your brain likes to think. And I like to feel I rounded out this little piece about Sail Away by saying that the girlfriend and I are now grandparents, you know. And as we push the babies in the park, we sing to ourselves that little line from Memo to My Son, which is on this on this record, which goes, wait till you learn how to talk, baby. I'll show you how smart I am. I just thought, this is a beautiful little vignette. I just wrote it quickly, banged it out, you know, appears in the New Statesman, everybody kind of happy. And then years later, they say, we want to put this in a book. Fine, can I use it? Yeah, fine. Then you got the problem. You got book publishers involved, and book publishers are terrified of quoting lyrics without permission.
Because they think they're going to get charged. And then someone's going to stop the presses just as they're about to roll.
So basically, I had to rewrite the end of it so that I kind of paraphrase those lines from the, you know, from the song, which is a shame you have to do that, really, isn't it? You know.
And let's be honest, they wouldn't care. They wouldn't notice, and even if they did, they wouldn't care.
Well, here's the golden rule about dealing with publishers and record companies and legal departments. Never ask for permission, always ask for forgiveness, you know, because permission, you'll never get it. Because, you know, somebody's job is just to say no.
Those times on music magazines, they used to ring up our lawyers and say, should I run this? And they'd always say, take it out.
Yeah, absolutely.
They say take it out because why not? Because it protects them. Because they said leave it in and it went wrong, then they'd be fired.
It's never a wrong answer, is it?
No, anyway. I know.
So who else is in this book alongside rock writer David Hepworth?
David Hepworth, exactly.
David Allen and Mark Hepworth.
Yeah, there's Suzanne Moore, Kate Mossman and Will Self and Lionel Shriver, Neil Tennant, all sorts of people. It's not just critics, really. It's mostly writers, isn't it? Novelist David Mitchell. I was reminded by how much I loved Clive James. Clive James talks about the album Ellington at Newport.
Yeah, yeah.
1956, and he was just a massive jazz head. And I love the way he writes. He said, I personally tested this to destruction on my Carriergram. I played it to death. And he talks about this. There's a live recording from 1956 Newport Jazz Festival, at which Duke's band tore the whole district to pieces. Yeah. I just used to love him, you know. And I remember him saying once that, talking about phraseology, he was saying, all I can do is turn a phrase until it catches the light.
Yeah, absolutely.
And yeah, I can still quote loads of them, you know, on Arnold Schwarzenegger. His body He has a body like a condom full of walnuts.
Absolutely. I'm going to go further. Doesn't he say it glistens like a condom full of walnuts?
Oh, maybe it is glistens.
I think.
Which is better.
The idea it catches the light again.
Yeah. That's better. There's a lovely one when he was writing about Rod Stewart in 1979. Rod Stewart used to wear those kind of ludicrous striped trousers. And he said he was described as hopping about like a bifurcated marrow. It's so good. Hopping about is such a great phrase. It's so sort of slightly demeaning, you know.
Oh, God.
And all this philosophical stuff, you say a life without fame can be a good life, but fame without a life at all, a life is no life at all. Fiction is life with the dull bits taken out. He's brilliant. He wrote a wonderful thing once about how he's never forgiven C.S. Lewis for going on long walks with Tolkien. For not strangling him. In fact, for not strangling each other, which would have saved everybody from hundreds of pages dripping with the wizardly wisdom of Gandalf and from the kind of movie in which Orlando Bloom defiantly flexes his delicate jaw at thousands of computer-generated orcs. You know, and it's a lovely idea, you know. But it did strike me that are there any critics who still have that kind of sway anymore? You know, you remember Anthony Lane would put out a film review and you just...
I do read Anthony Lane's film reviews for pleasure.
Yeah.
Because he's a fabulous writer and, you know, very thoughtful. I don't then think, I must go and see that film or anything like that. I just read it on its own as a pleasure, you know. So I tend to like the really writerly ones whose writing you enjoy.
Yeah.
Rather than somebody quickly telling me whether the center is worth seeing or reading or whatever. Because I find increasingly tend to get those kind of tips from social media.
I do entirely. I mean, it was such a long time ago thinking of kind of Nick Kent writing about Marquee Moon. It was nearly 50 years ago now. But that's one of those occasions where you hadn't heard the record and he had, and he thought, well, I'm going to run out and buy it on the strength of his opinion, you know. But now I don't think any of that kind of affects me at all. All the stuff that I've been watching through lockdown, you know, Tiger King and the Queen's Gambit and Unorthodox and Call My Agent, all those things. And I'm soon going to be watching Gods of Snooker because everyone says it's so good. You know, that's entirely been social media. And no, apparently it's great. And it's been social media. And
yourself. Well, yeah, really, it's great. Yeah,
you know, I'm convincing myself, I know. But that's also just mates, isn't it? Mates whose opinions you trust. You know, that's what it's about. If somebody says, somebody who you like and you've got the same kind of taste says, listen to this or watch this, you do.
Yeah.
And also, there's no compulsion to see everything at the same time anymore. The whole thing used to be, you've got to make a decision now because this record or this film will only be here for a short period of time and you've got to get out there quick. And I'm not bothered anymore. Nothing's going to go away, you know.
No, that's true. That's true. So the Friends reunion,
yeah,
I caught up with some of it this morning. I quite enjoyed it actually in an odd way.
I watched Have you watched it or just? I've just watched all the available stuff because I just couldn't get around to paying for it. But did you watch the whole thing?
Oh, I haven't watched the whole thing. No, but I got a flavour of it. You know, with them all very, you know, theatrically, cinematically. Arriving on the set individually, you know, stepping into the huge great soundstage to see the old set, you know, recreated.
There's some good bits, some very good bits. The bit about very cleverly positioned kind of news bombshell that David Schwimmer and Jennifer Aniston fancied each other. And we're having a kind of on-off kind of romance, weren't they? I thought that was this good news story.
Yeah.
There's one really funny line when she gets to Jennifer Aniston and looks at the set and says, has it got smaller or we can't have got any bigger, can we? And Matt LeBlanc goes, speak for yourself.
Yeah, absolutely.
Matt LeBlanc now looks like a kind of, you know, a barn door.
He looks like not an actor, doesn't he?
Yeah, really. Yeah.
Or he looks like somebody who's transitioned to character parts rather than, you know, kind of the young hunk.
Yeah.
I was watching the bit this morning where they remembered meeting each other and they remember meeting each other at the table read for the first one. And Jennifer Aniston could remember exactly what the other women were wearing, but couldn't remember what the blokes were wearing. And
brilliant
to prove, bear out once more my theory, which I've expounded quite recently on this podcast, that if a female of the species has to describe an item of clothing, she will draw it upon her body.
Yeah.
Jennifer Aniston does that exactly without thinking. She goes, Courtney was wearing a little T-shirt like this and it had flowers and so forth.
Yeah, yeah.
She gestures. And I thought, crying out loud, that's Jennifer Aniston doing that. High-profile actress in an incredibly high-profile TV program, and she doesn't know she's doing it. It proves my point. Other interesting fact, do you know what the piece of music is that introduces the Friends reunion? Highly rated TV program of 2021, major event. I thought,
it's guitar not the Rembrandt thing.
It's guitar instrumental. I thought, I know this. What's this? Who is this? Leo Kottke or something? And then it came to me, introducing the Friends reunion is Embryonic Journey by the Jefferson Airplane from 1967.
Wow.
Is it? It's probably
Why
on
was that chosen? Interesting.
Somebody just likes it, obviously. It just kind of fitted in there. But, you know, what's the best line in the history of Friends? It struck me, Mark.
Okay, that's a good one. Well, I
go on. Shall I tell you mine?
Oh, well, I can only think of those kind of Chandler phrases where, can this martini be any drier? You know, that's when he gets a tiny little...
My favourite is the one where, and I can't remember who the third party is in this, where Rachel gets jealous that Monica's got another female friend.
Oh, I remember that. Yes.
And
they go shopping.
And she says to her, and she's just trying to get to how far this friendship is, how far it's gone. And she says, you didn't go shopping with her, did you? And she goes, yes, tense. And then she goes, you didn't go to Bloomingdale's, did you? And she clutches her throat at this point, like, you didn't go to Bloomingdale's, did you? And Monica goes, yes, but only once. And I was thinking of you all the time. She's just
think of you all the time. That's
just absolutely brilliant.
That is such a clever line, isn't it?
And that's the kind of, I mean, it's just kind of wispy stuff like that, you know, that really sticks with me. You know, when I go and watch it, because I haven't watched it for ages, actually. And
no, that's a brilliant understanding of the female sensibility.
Completely. And and also it turns round a kind of standard male excuse for infidelity into something female.
Yeah.
And but it struck me they're never going to make another television program like that at all, are they?
The Word Podcast, prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
We interrupt this podcast for a game of what we're calling Stamp Wardy. Okay, I can't remember how this came up.
I tell you how it came up.
Rock stars who are on
postage stamps.
Oh, what?
I got this.
Oh, look at that.
I know. There we are, which is my Paul McCartney stamps and postcards. There we go.
Oh, what?
There they are. No, which is pathetic. I know.
So what are all those? Are they solo records? Is that,
solo records. Yeah, they are.
Oh,
there
that's...
They are.
Ram,
the first one, Venus and Mars. I mean, isn't that lovely?
So if I went to a post office, could I buy
them? Yeah, you can buy them. I just thought, just to make absolutely sure, and I got my set of postcards too, you see. Look, they are pretty nice. But I just thought I'd order them online, which I did do. And it just made me think, who's been on... Shall I tell you if I know?
Right, rock people have been on stamps. Yes, go on.
They are, I think, the Beatles... And then John Lennon in 1988. Then there was Elton John. Then there was Queen. Then there was the Floyd, but not the Floyd as in pictures of the members of the Floyd, you know.
Yeah, well, that's fair enough.
No, they're just their album sleeves. And then Paul McCartney. And then there was an album covers series in 2010, Power, Corruption and Lies, London and Calling, Led Zeppelin 4, et cetera, et cetera. And that's kind of about it. And it made me think, you know, who's next?
Well, according to, I've got a list here, and I'm going to test you. You know, has David Bowie been on a postage stamp?
No, he hasn't.
Yes, he has.
Okay. Has he?
Well, according to Wikipedia, has.
Oh, all right. I'm wrong.
Okay. Has Les Dawson been on a postage stamp?
I'm sure he has.
He has been on
postage stamp. National Treasure.
Absolutely. Has Peter Cook been on a
Yes, he has.
Stamp?
I know.
Yeah,
that for
okay.
A fact.
Very, very good. All right. Rich Dimbleby. Has he been on the postage stamp?
Can't have been, Richard.
Yes, he was on a postage
stamp. How did that happen?
2013. I don't know. How
I've got one for you. Bradley Wiggins.
Must have been.
He has.
Yeah, they're kind of Olympic gold medalists. They probably, they did a whole set
Hitchcock.
Of them. Surely, Alfred Hitchcock.
He has.
Okay. Prince Harry has, I see from my list here. Fred Perry. Has Peter Sellers ever been on a postage stamp?
God, you'd think he should have been.
Well, he has, according to this.
Yeah.
And, Sir Walter Scott, obviously. Ralph Vaughan Williams on a postage stamp.
Must have been.
Billy Wright.
More British.
There's a long list here. Anyway, so there are no prizes there. But I'm going to go and get some of those Paul McCartney stamps.
Oh, they're great.
I like the look of those.
But I'm thinking, who are the next contenders? In the rock and roll pop pantheon.
Firmament.
Because it can't be, you know, your Ed Sheerans and your Adeles have not been around long enough. There's something not quite right about The Who. I don't know if they appeared now.
The Who, I would have thought, are ripe to be on a postage stamp.
Well, just down the board.
Because, you know, Heinz, they recently did... they did a special Heinz can of Heinz baked beans.
Oh, they did.
To remember Roger Daltrey in the bath full of beans.
Yeah,
the cover of Who Sell Out. So I imagine The Who. I'll tell you who I'm thinking. Surely, ought to be in a postage stamp. But I'm not saying this because I'm a fan or anything like that. But surely Oasis, you would have thought. They're a big UK band, aren't they?
Big UK band. A lot of Union Jacks were involved at one point, weren't they?
And
they
also,
look good.
And
they're also uniquely British.
Noel would
British
love
about.
It, wouldn't he? He'd love it.
He'd love it.
Postage stamp.
He'd love it. Okay, other contenders, I think, Pet Shop Boys are getting
there. Oh, okay. Now, that's
I think
good.
Pet Shop Boys are moving into National Treasure.
Very good.
And I tell you another two that I think are absolutely, it's got to happen. One is Madness.
Oh, yes.
Everybody loves Madness. They look fabulous, don't they? Everyone's got a favourite member of Madness, etc. And Kate Bush. Kate Bush, surely.
Yeah, no, surely. Surely.
Kate Bush, you either love Kate Bush or you just generally approve of the idea.
No, they do. Yeah, absolutely. I think those are good suggestions. I think Pet Shop Boys is a really good suggestion.
Yeah, people love them.
Because Neil would love the idea of being on the stamp.
He would.
Who wouldn't, for goodness sake?
But there's also various ones on the edge, I think. The Jam, Smith.
On the edge, very good. On the edge.
Yeah.
See what you did there? That's very good. But you said the Jam, yes, possibly, yeah.
Jam, Smiths. I don't know.
No.
No, probably not now.
You have some objection to the post.
No, they have to be part
that the glue is wrong or something like that. These are the means by which, you know, final demands are sent or eviction orders. No. I will not have anything to do with that.
That's right.
Because I am too pure.
Return to sender. Yeah.
No, those are good.
Kinks is possible. Kylie, but she's not British, of course.
I don't know. Commonwealth. Can you get away with that?
Yeah, you probably could.
There's probably a stamp for Dame Kiri Takanawa. So why couldn't there be one for Dame Kylie Minogue? For goodness sake.
But it's funny, isn't it? Because there's certain people who fit and don't fit. It's like Rod Stewart. I'm not sure it quite fits somehow. I don't know why. That you've got to be kind of generally adored and approved of and not too badly behaved. See, the Stones. I don't think there's ever been a Stones stamp.
I can't see a Rod Stewart stamp. You would always kind of suspect that it was a bit hooky. And that the postman wasn't going to deliver it. You know? it would not be proper currency. And a rod would be having a nice little earner out of it somewhere.
He'd be trousering a wedge. It would be a nice little drink in it for him.
Yeah. So if you've got any suggestions as to who ought to be on a stamp, please send us a postcard.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
So here we are. Alex Gold has come out of the back room to join us in the front. He's come with the grown-ups. He's coming to the main room. You've been allowed out. Alex, how are you doing?
I'm
all right.
Yeah, I'm fine.
You're on your best behaviour. No swearing. He's ironed his T-shirt.
We like to think on this podcast we bring you, you know, our definitive judgment on the issues that divide us, you know,
indeed,
as a society. To that end, we thought we should just finally work out who's best, Britney Spears or Taylor Swift. And Mark Allen and I think we've got our
heads. We know the answer.
We know the answer.
We're absolutely confident we know the answer. We've got a feeling that your answer will actually be the opposite. So a free and frank exchange of views may develop.
Shall we just tell him what we think, first of all, what our answer is?
Please do, yes.
Okay.
Indulge
well,
me.
Just write this down, Alex, you know, so you don't forget it. The answer is Britney Spears. You know, it's as simple as that. For goodness' sake, she's a genuine, fascinating pop phenomenon. You know, you can spend years thinking about Britney Spears. You can't spend very long thinking about Taylor Swift.
Also, the thing about Britney Spears is you get the impression that actually it was a lot of people recognizing her talent and pushing her along, her mum driving her along to join the School of Performing Arts and all that, you know, rather than her being fiercely ambitious. It's almost as if it all happened by mistake, you know. And I love the fact that she's so fallible, isn't she, Dave? She does.
Oh, very
fallible.
Go
wrong.
Absolutely.
She snogged Madonna on the MTV Awards. She married a bloke at one point for 55 hours. Excellent.
That's what we want.
I think that's excellent. I think she's just, you know, it's real life, isn't it?
I just read here that we can look forward to soon there's going to be a musical called, what's it going to be called? Once Upon a One More Time. Which it sees new musical sees classic princesses radicalized by feminist literature and the musical stylings of Britney Spears. So that's coming along new from the Shakespeare Theatre Company in Washington DC. That's get your tickets here soon. You know, so that's what we think of Britney Spears. But you're in the opposite, how can I put it, wrong corner, aren't you, Alex, on this argument? Tell us where you're coming from.
Well, first of all, I'm really glad that you guys know the answer to this. However,
so
the right answer, of course,
down
is Taylor Swift. And it's just the fact. She's just amazing at everything. And she wrote Shake It Off, and she can write 15 songs a day and they're all brilliant. She's collaborated with everyone. She's so in control of her own career and her own creativity. She's the boss's boss. She's one pop. And, you know, I want to be on the team of the person who's one pop.
Oh, I see.
Isn't there something slightly, I'm interjecting here, something slightly cold and
cynical
about her? You know, if I remember rightly, her father was a stockbroker, right? Mum was a mutual fund marketing executive. She identifies as a Christian. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but that's something just a little bit un-rock and roll.
Calculating, I think.
She's unbelievably, fiercely efficient and controlling. And there's a suggestion I get, Dave. I don't know if you, as you as an ex-teacher would know that, as a kind of apple for teacher. Sir, first one with the hand up. You know what I mean?
She's the head girl.
Brittany
is not head girl.
She lived in this country.
Brittany is smoking behind the bike shed.
Yeah, totally.
Whereas Taylor is head girl. And I'm going to suggest, Alex, that that's what you like about her, isn't it?
I kind of do. Taylor is someone you would obey.
Oh, right, okay.
And Brittany is someone you would question automatically. If you were asked to accompany Britney or Taylor on a bungee jump, which one would you choose? I would wager it would probably be Taylor, because Britney's bungee jump would probably go wrong.
You'd die.
I think it's an extreme circumstance that it's very unlikely to involve either Dave or myself. But I take your point. But there's something, there's something milk-fed and wholesome about it, isn't it? And you get the impression her body is a shrine in a temple. She's having the sort of breakfast that you have every day, magic. You know, made up of berries I've never heard of, and live yogurt cultures bubbling away in your airing cupboard.
Exactly. Taylor's a safe pair of hands. Brittany is relatable. You know, we all feel sorry for her a little bit. She's the more human of the two. We'd like to give her a big cuddle. But Taylor, you trust to take your baby son to school for you.
Okay. Well, I give you that. Would I? Who would I hire to look after the children? Yes, Taylor Swift. I give you that.
Yeah.
You know, but pop stars is a different thing. You're looking for something different. Anyway.
I think people care about Britney on a personal level.
They do.
They care about Taylor Swift because they like the idea of Taylor Swift. But I don't know if they feel that's strongly about her on a person.
Well, I'd like to say this debate will run and run, but it won't because Mark and I have settled it because there's two of us and
two to one. That's the aggregate score.
And we're older than you are, you know, so it's as simple as that. But tune in next week for another major pop face off. We'll decide other important questions of popular music. While we've been doing this, I tweeted saying, you know, we're recording a podcast. Has anybody got any questions? And we got a few here. Paul Monahan wants to know, during all these Word in Your Attic, Zoom with a View, whatever that we've done over the last year, who do we think has been the artist most mentioned or discussed? Mark, what do you think?
Oh, Lord. Well, I would have thought Joni Mitchell's Blue album, if we're talking about actual records.
Now, I think you're talking about an artist.
Well,
it's the Beatles.
Undoubtedly the Beatles.
It's the Beatles.
But that's because we go back to the Beatles at times of hardship and we find great comfort. In fact, this morning we are talking about Paul McCartney's Stamps. So absolutely. No, it's the Beatles. Of course it's got a bit
of a warm glow there.
I can tell you empirically because when I upload videos to Patreon, I always tag.
Of course.
Just in case people want to search for an
artist. Yeah.
And the Beatles are the most tagged artist on the Word in Your Eye.
There you go.
No surprises there.
This next one comes from NG Laurie Books. Swim, cycle, or run? What is your fitness regime?
Not the idea that I've got a regime. Well, it was cycle, but unfortunately, about 3 months ago, I had a bit of a cycle, spill.
He had a bit of a prang, readers.
A bit of a prang. So I've been limping around for a while, but I'm back on the bike. I'm afraid a lot of walking, but no swimming.
Back on the bike. Yeah. Stephen Green wants to know how you are, Mark, because you've not tweeted anything since 2015. I think, Stephen, if you've been paying attention on these clips, you know, he's doing this almost every day, you know.
No, I just rather gave up on Twitter, actually. I'm still following thousands of people. I just don't tweet myself. I'm there. I'm watching in the wings.
All right. So first post-lockdown live gig. Any artist still alive, any venue, who would you pick? Who's it to be? Alex? Do you have one up front of mind?
I've got no one specific, but I probably wanted to go to something really small and really sweaty just to feel like I was at
sweat
again. Yeah. I want to go watch like a psychobilly band in a dive bar or something. Just something like that to just get out of my system.
Okay. Mark?
God, well, I think I'd go to the Shepherd's Bush Empire, actually. It's about a mile from here, and it's my absolute fave venue. Lovely old Victorian theatre where we once saw Bob Dylan. That's exciting. We were so excited. We went down there as a family and photographed ourselves outside the venue with a thing above saying Bob Dylan tonight and his band. Artists, don't know. Go on, you suggest yours, Dave.
I was going to say Shepherd's Bush Empire as well. As long as you and I, because I assume we're going together, because we are joined at the hip.
We're joined at the hip.
And
when people see us in the street, they think, where's the other one? Don't they? How's Dave? People say to me, how's Dave? He's fine. Oh, you just missed him. He's here a minute ago.
We've been to Shepherd's Bush Empire, I think, a couple of times. And stood in the same place, which is on the right at the balcony.
Yeah.
Which I always thought was the most brilliant viewing vantage point at any gig. Because nobody can get in front of you. And
you're right up above the stage, you can see everything.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we saw Dylan there. You could pretty much read the lyrics of the songs that he had in front of him on his little keyboard that he was clearly reading.
Yeah, who would I like to see? I don't know, Crowded the House in the Shepherds of Bush Empire. Okay, that'll do. We've actually gone from Danny Baker here, whoever he is, and he wants to know who are the bands or artists who took the longest to come on stage in your memory. While you're thinking, I once saw, this must have been in the early 80s, Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, and I think the Victoria, or the New Victoria Theatre, or one of those theatres down at Victoria. And they were somewhat unused to the conventions of live performance. So the support act had been on, whoever they were, I can't remember. And then they took a long time to get to come on, Orchestral Maneuvers. Just like, you know, the audience just start getting antsy. They just feel that their piss has been taken, you know, when a band are more than a certain amount of time. And so there's a bit of a half-hearted slow hand clapping. And when the curtains finally opened and Andy Bukowski was revealed...
I remember this.
He went, all right! Which I thought, that just shows you how little understanding musical performers have of the basic transaction between you and the customer, you know what I mean? They've paid, you're supposed to be on stage.
You're supposed to be entertaining them.
Your job to apologise, for God's sake.
Yeah.
Don't you know, take umbrage with them. Anybody, have you waited?
Oh, God, well, the classic one for me, and anybody else who was there would remember this, was Nebworth 1976.
Right.
Which was where the Stones were headlining and second on the bill was 10cc. And after the third act, there was a pause for about an hour where 10cc fiddled around with all their equipment and said, look, we've been told, I'm afraid, that the generators are a bit faulty and we can't get a kind of a constant, you know, electrical supply, and it's affecting the notes on the keyboards and things are going out. All this movie thinking, what is going on? You know, by the end, by the time 10cc got on stage, people were hurling bottles at them, you know. Transpired later on, as I discovered when interviewing Eric Stewart of 10cc for the NME in 1979. But actually what happened was that Keith Richards, and we can say this because I've interviewed Keith Richards and put this story to him and he agrees that it was true. But Keith Richards was so out of it and so unable to play that they had to buy a bit of time. So the Stones roadies cut through the multi-core cables leading to the PA, which meant that the 10cc roadies had to splice them all back together again. And by the time they did that, it had given the Stones an hour more of Keith Richards in bed, being given whatever pick-me-up might be required to get him vertical and on stage. That's fantastic. So by the time they came on, we drunk our cider. We pretty much fallen asleep. It was about midnight.
What about you, Alex?
A long time.
Go on.
The second last show I went to see before coronavirus was Liam Gallagher in Vienna. And he was pretty late. And I like to think he got waylaid trying to figure out what staggy doll means.
What means?
Staggy door. It's a joke. Stage door.
Staggy door.
I'll get me cope.
No, staggy door.
I've lost this final one, but it was somebody saying, asking the night, the day after the European final, what is the best football-related record? What is it? Well, I know the answer.
I still think it's Three Lions on the Shirt.
That's the answer.
It's just the greatest music football record ever made. It's just fabulous.
And do you know
everything
why,
about it is fabulous.
You know why it's so good? I mean, it's a really good tune and all that.
Yeah.
But what's good about it is it celebrates failure. And failure never goes out of style at all, does it? You know, it's the one permanent feature of all our interest in sport.
Yeah,
it might work, but it probably won't.
Probably won't.
And so it
anticipates failure, so it can only be pleasantly surprised. Whereas all the others are, we will win, and it's going to be a crushing disappointment.
Yeah,
fantastic.
Well, thank you for your questions. That's been an interesting addition to the Where Did You Read podcast. Any other business? Have we got anything else to talk about? Don't forget your tickets for July the 17th. We are live in Holland Park with Gary Crowley, Leslie Ann Jones. More details being announced in the next few days. We've been down there and recce'd the site. It looks very exciting, doesn't it? Really,
it's absolutely gorgeous.
And those people who got there early and got their kind of VIP tickets are effectively sitting on thrones, aren't they, Alex?
They are royalty.
Absolutely.
And it's under canvas, so nothing can go wrong. Although we fully expect it to be a scorching hot day. Absolutely. What can possibly go wrong?
Book the weather.
Yeah, yeah, we've booked the weather. It's going to be corking afternoon between 2 and 4 in the afternoon on Saturday, July 17th in Holland Park in West London. Anything else to add?
We have a batch. What is the collective noun of patrons? I do not know.
A blessing.
A blessing.
Go on.
And they are Adrian Craddock.
Hello, Adrian.
Hello, Adrian.
Terry Lee.
Take a throne, Terry.
Terry Lee, excellent.
Mike Mooney.
Would you like a chaise longue, Mike?
Ben Timlett.
I've got a fainting couch for Mr. Ben.
David Longbotham.
A Chesterfield.
I was just trying to think of what it was.
With a damp paw pressed to a forehead.
A Chesterfield.
Not feeling
absolutely
very well.
Go on. Let's see if we can keep doing this. Go on.
And Ben Knowles.
Ben Knowles.
Oh, no, we know
we're
going to
rather find Lloyd Loom chair for Ben Knowles there. Well, thank you very much to all of them. And to anybody who'd like to join them or wants to find out more about how they can do that, go to patreon.com/word in your ear. Is that right, Alex? Anything else? Anything else we should say? We got more Word in Your Attics coming up over the next few days. What have we most recently posted? Simon Garfield's
got up, which is really good.
Phil
Manzanera, of course.
That's good.
What else have we recorded that we haven't put out yet?
Catherine Mayer.
Yeah. And lots more exciting ones coming up in the next few weeks. So stay tuned.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.